coming for star fruits, starch, and starbursts. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 184, and of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your grungy, gregarious group of groupers grasping for gripping granules.
I'm Colin.
And I'm Chris.
And no Dana this week.
No Dana.
She had a little stomach trouble.
Not feeling well.
Yeah. So sorry, folks. Hopefully she'll do better.
By the time you hear this, she'll be all better.
Get well soon, Dana. Yeah. Yay. And Chris, I saw that you found a bizarre headline to
I found a headline. I found a headline that I wanted to bring up because I thought that you might want to know. the Linkin Park Zoo in Chicago. Linkin Park Zoo in Chicago, they recently had a camel born. In front of the public. It was the first camel born at the zoo since 1998. The first camel born at the Linkin Park Zoo in Chicago since 1998.
Oh my God, I don't think I've ever seen or heard of camel births.
Yeah, well they do.
They do have
babies. But the headline is that they've named the camel.
Is it a pun of some kind, Chris?
It might be a pun of some kind.
Humphrey.
It's not
Humphrey.
Nor Joe Camel. Those are a little too.
They're not going to associate
camel. True. Humphrey's good. I like that.
Lumps.
Camel.
Camel.
It's not
caramel.
Camel. Yeah.
Oh man, this is like a Laffy Taffy joke.
I know. Yeah.
Is it gettable?
It's gettable. Yeah, it's gettable.
Spitty.
Related to how about this? He's a historical figure named after a historical figure.
Albert Camel.
Kind of
a little bit of a reach, I suppose.
Albert Camus and the Plagooey. Oh, famous person.
Historical figure.
Is it a girl or a boy?
It's a boy. It's named after a boy. He has a first and a last name. You know, popular historical figure who maybe enjoying a bit of a resurgence in popular culture these days.
Alexander Humpleton.
Alexander Camelton.
Colin got it. It's Alexander Camelton. You're so focused on Hump.
On the Hump,
Alexander
yes.
Humpington.
You got me more than halfway there, Karen. Yeah.
That's right. It was really a team effort. But if we ever have a camel, we're definitely going to call him Alexander Humpington. Why not Alexander Camelton? Two on the nose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just, that's two.
I guess I don't want to name it anything with humping.
Right. Also, we probably should not be given a camel.
But we can name one.
Don't send us a camel.
Yeah, we'll gladly accept naming rights.
Hey, oh, right.
I don't know
right.
if you guys know, but, you know, anytime. Not anytime.
Anytime.
But when like zoos have baby animals and they call for names, I always submit.
Do you really?
Names. Yeah.
That shouldn't surprise me.
And they're just sometimes they're punny, sometimes they're weird.
I like that.
Like Disney had before they got rid of the petting zoo, they had baby goats.
Uh-huh.
And so I wrote in and suggest. Oh yeah, and then another, I think Ontario, I post this on Good Job Brain Facebook, had a bunch of litter of beavers, beaver kits.
Nice.
And we're like, we gotta name them.
And
you know how Dana signs up when there's earthquake. Dana's like the first to go
register
to report it, you know, in the government.
That's
website.
You, but with baby animal
that's
naming.
Me, yeah. Oh, Alexander Humpington. Missed opportunity.
Should have called him Engelbert Cameldink.
So dumb. So we're recording this the week of June 6th, and which is very close because the Belmont Stakes are happening. Mm-hmm. This is a part of our, you know, in pub trivia, we have a couple of not blind spots.
It comes up a lot.
It comes up.
Comes up a
so
lot.
So much. And the only person who knows this is Colin.
Yeah.
Like anything about the horses. And I've been to Churchill Downs. And I came in, what is that? Kentucky Derby? Yeah, because it's in Kentucky. But like.
You're talking about like which of the Triple Crown races? Like what the. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here, let's do a primer. Chris, feel free to join in.
Well, how about this? I'll tell you how I remember the order.
Okay.
How about that?
What is the order of. So. This is United States Triple Crown. The official name is Triple Crown of Thoroughbred Racing.
Right.
This is the U.S. version. There are three major horse races What are the order?
So the I hope I'm correct here, right? Okay. Well, so the biggest and most famous is the Kentucky Derby, mm-hmm. and that kicks things off. All right, so I just remember like that's first because mm-hmm. it's someone everyone heard of.
Okay, kicking things off.
Oh, Kentucky. Sure, I like that. Okay. I like that. And then there is the Preakness, which is the second race, and then the last one is the Belmont Stakes.
Yeah.
And so the way I remember it is like, all right, so Kentucky Derby is just the first one because it's the famous one. The Preakness is like it's peaking. The action, ooh. The excitement is nice, peaking nice. In the middle. Mm-hmm. And then the Belmont, it's like you're going for the bell. The bell lap, the final, like you're
that.
Coming in.
Beautiful.
And that's what
I
helps me
it.
Remember the order.
Okay, Colin.
Yeah.
Which race is the longest?
I believe it is the middle one, the Preakness.
Incorrect.
Oh,
it is
no.
Belmont
is it? Okay.
Stakes, 2.4 kilometers, 1.5 miles.
Okay.
Which is the shortest, the Preakness?
The shortest is the Preakness.
Okay. I'll flip-flop those.
All right. Yeah, so the last one is the longest one. Where are they held? What city are they held?
Well, so the Kentucky Derby, obviously, is in Kentucky.
Louisville, okay. Louisville, Kentucky.
All right.
Kentucky.
I've never been there.
Preakness is located in Maryland.
Right. In
Baltimore. And then Belmont Stakes.
Is in New York.
Yes. Elmont, New York. So it's Belmont without the B.
At the Elmont.
So if you're a horse, not if you're a horse, but like...
when you're a horse.
The Triple Crown is a series of races, but to get the Triple Crown, you must win all three.
Right.
When was the last time a horse won all three?
Oh.
We were just talking about it last year because we were on track for one last year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember.
And it was last year, 2015. American Pharoah.
Oh, that's right.
Before that, it was 1978 was the last one.
And was that affirmed? Oh,
wow. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Affirmed?
You know your horses. I can only name Secretariat because they made that into a movie.
They did.
All right, so there's a quick horse racing trivia primer.
This comes up on trivia all the time.
And it's 1 in 3, but most of the time we get it wrong. All right. And without further ado... let's jump into our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz, Hot Shot. Colin versus Chris, I have a smorgasbord of random trivia cards. I got Baby Boomer Trivial Pursuit.
Love it.
Silver Screen Trivial Pursuit.
Love it.
Genus 4 Trivial Pursuit and a TV on the Go Trivia card, which isn't even Trivial Pursuit.
Mm.
Here's random. You guys have your Barnyard Buzzer. Does the Rooster Buzzer have a fresh battery in? Oh, nice. All right.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Right hand, left hand?
Left hand.
Okay. Colin, right hand, left hand.
Oh, left hand.
Okay.
What is your method?
Well, I just separate them.
Oh, okay.
Here we go. TV trivia on the go. Oh, man.
Oh, it's this one.
I'm not a fan of these cards, but that's what we drew.
Okay. Here we go. No categories because they're all TV. And multiple choice. What was Mary's brother's name on the Donna Reed Show?
Goodness.
Was it
All right.
Jeff,
mm-hmm.
Rick,
uh-huh.
or Bud?
Bud.
Incorrect.
Mm.
Given the general time period.
I don't even know what time period this is. Incorrect. It is Jeff.
Wow.
Good old Jeff.
It's a very early
what
Jeff.
What is the Donna Reed Show? I have no idea. In what movie did Superman's George Reeves make his debut? Is it Gone with the Wind, Key Largo, or The Maltese Falcon? Chris.
Key Largo.
Incorrect.
The Maltese Falcon.
Incorrect. It is Gone with the Wind.
Now I want to see if we can do this for every question, if we can incorrectly guess 2 out of 3.
All right. Leonard Sly is better known as whom? Ed Sullivan, Milton Berle, or Roy Rogers? Colin.
Roy Rogers.
Correct! Because Roy Rogers sounds like a fake name.
It does.
Yeah.
It really
yep.
does.
Yeah. Leonard Sly.
Leonard All Sly. Right. That's a good one. Okay.
Hmm.
From what Tennessee town did the Beverly Hillbillies come from?
Oh, geez.
Is it... Possum Point, Hooterville, or Bug Tussle? Colin.
Hooterville.
incorrect, Chris.
Possum Point.
It is Bug Tussle.
No! Man, I thought for sure, like, I would have put money that if it wasn't Hooterville, it was Possum Point. Wow.
Bug Tussle.
Man, I never watched that one growing up. I really didn't.
Okay, now we're in a more recent era.
Oh, so the 70s?
90s.
Oh, okay. Oh, hey, I'm surprised this set is that new, frankly.
On Beverly Hills 90210, who played Brenda Walsh's best friend, Kelly?
Oh.
Oh, I'm not going to give you... Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
I believe that is Jenny Garth.
Correct.
Okay.
Jenny Garth.
Now, were the other two choices also people that were on...
Yeah, why don't you guess the other actresses?
Shannon Doherty and...
No.
Gabrielle Carteris.
Yes, Gabrielle Carteris and...
Tori Spelling.
Yep. Tiffany Amber... Oh, okay.
Tori Spelling.
All right.
Who played Mork and Mindy's son? Whoa.
Sorry, I forget that these are... Yeah, I know who...
Okay.
It was Jonathan Winters.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good job.
Yeah, he played Mirth from Earth, who was son of Mork from Ork.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Wait, so Mork and Mindy had a kid?
They had a kid, and again, I show off my nerd side here. So I was a big Mork and Mindy fan. So as you may recall, in Mork species, they age backwards.
Oh, really?
So their son was born as like an adult Jonathan Winters, right.
Oh my God.
Yeah, wisecracking just right from day one.
Who is the producer behind many of the reality shows, including Survivor?
Many of the reality shows,
including Survivor and The Apprentice.
Mark Burnett.
Correct. I wasn't giving you the names, but once I said Survivor,
yeah, Chris is all over
Chris
that one.
In.
The reality
shows. The reality shows.
Which
is now all television. Really tell us carbs in the 90s.
Wow, you know this one, Chris.
Yeah?
What was the name of the lying contestant on the original The Apprentice?
Of the lying contestant?
Yeah. Quote, lying contestant.
Oh, Omarosa?
Correct.
Okay.
Mm.
Who was the first female head writer for Saturday Night Live?
I think I know.
Okay, together.
Tina Fey.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
The other two names were Gilda Radner, fantastic, not head writer, and Mary Gross, who was in our favorite movie, True Beverly Hills.
Oh, True Beverly Hills and Feds.
Last question.
I'm a big Mary Gross fan. She's great.
What nickname did Mr. Edwards give Laura on Little House on the Prairie? I have choices.
I'll gladly take the choices here. Yeah,
let's go choices.
All right. Knee high.
Uh-huh.
Half pint or squirt.
Okay.
I
was going to guess.
I like squirt. I don't know why.
What were you going to guess?
Garbage can.
It is half pint.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Yep.
I bet
yep.
Dana would have gotten that half one. Pint.
All right. Good job, brains. That was a weird. I mean, all these cards are actually hard.
I'm sure they're all just terrible.
Because they're all from a time long ago. That we don't get. So, Colin, what are we talking about this week?
Well, so, as you guys know, you know me well, and I think our listeners probably do. I watch a lot of Simpsons. So, this week's topic was directly, indirectly inspired by one of my favorite episodes of The Simpsons, which I was casually watching a few days ago. And it is the episode where they go to the chili cook-off. Mm. And while they're at the chili cook-off, Marge... is off looking at a craft booth, actually run by Lenny. The name of the craft booth is A Little Bit of Lenny.
I didn't even watch the show, and it's funny.
And so she's looking at some of Lenny's handmade crafts, and she sees a spice rack. And I'll read it for you. I enjoy it. So she looks at, ooh, look at that adorable spice rack. 8 spices. Oh, some must be doubles. And then she picks one up and looks at it. And she's all, oregano? What the hell? So that's one of my favorite Marge scenes. I just cannot fathom that there could possibly be more than 8 spices in the world. right. Oh, and just as a side note, I was going online to make sure I got the wording of the scene exactly correct because – rest assured somebody would let me know if I didn't.
Yeah.
And I found out many Simpsons fans who live in England or other Commonwealth countries, they were all chiming in saying, like, it was years before I actually got this joke, because in British English, you do pronounce it oregano. And so the joke is that Marge, of course, having never heard of it, doesn't know how to pronounce it the American proper way.
Interesting.
Oregano. Yeah. So a lot of British viewers were like, oh, I didn't get the joke for the longest time.
Oh, I didn't get it either.
Yes. Oregano, not oregano. Yeah. The joke being that Marge has never heard of oregano.
Oregano.
Right.
Oregano.
Oregano.
Okay. So that got me thinking about spices and herbs and things of that nature, and I thought that would be a perfect topic for Good Job Brain.
So this week, spice up your life.
Well, oregano, it is a plant, and it's like the dried, you know, leaves of...
Like an herb?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an herb, right. Or if you are speaking British English...
Herb.
Yes,
oregano,
herbs.
The herb.
Oregano, the herb, yes. Well, this is a good question, actually, and I can see
I don't want to hear anything about how we're too, quote-unquote, America-centric anymore, okay?
Let me ask you guys, what is the difference between herbs and spices? What's an herb and what is a spice?
Herb is knows.
Yeah, I mean, an herb is a leaf of a plant, and a spice is made from, I think, ground seeds or berries.
Well, what's cinnamon, like, then? Cinnamon's bark.
Cinnamon is bark. Yeah. So it's like...
Is that herb or a spice?
It's not an herb.
Okay. Cinnamon's a spice. Okay. Cinnamon's a spice. Yeah. Yeah, you
stuff
got
like
it. You
nature.
Got it. I'm gonna jump in. Just
you can give me the gnome.
You've got the spirit of it. No, it's pretty much it. Yeah, herbs are the difference between herbs and spices depends on what part of the plant it comes from. Herbs are just the leaves or the green part of the plant, and spices are basically everything else. Seeds, bark, roots, like the woody portion, right? Mm-hmm. And you also sort of touched on it, like not always, but generally speaking, most spices are dried, whereas herbs can be either dried or fresh. You can have fresh herbs. For the most part, most spices, cinnamon, you know, anything like that, they tend to be dried, ground. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you got it. That's the difference between herbs and spices.
Mm-hmm. Spicy.
Yeah.
Spices.
But we don't call it an herb rack. We call it a spice rack.
That's right.
Just one of the big injustices in the kitchen. I have nothing to add for that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if I had to guess, I'd say that it probably started out like you just had spices on your spice rack, and then herbs were in your garden.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Fresh,
oh,
and then
okay,
the
yeah.
I think
modern
right.
drying technology gave us the jar of oregano. Yeah.
And there are, of course, you know, some
now
plants.
I don't know what you really call that thing.
You can call it either one. In America, America's oregano.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. There are, of course, some plants where we do both. Like, famously, you know, we get this one in trivia a lot. Like
coriander?
Exactly.
Oh,
like the cilantro. Like the cilantro plant. Like, if you use the leaves, it's cilantro. If you use the seeds, it's coriander. But they come from the same plant. And there aren't a whole lot of plants where we use them in both ways like that. But that's a good example. I did a lot of fell into a spice hole getting ready for this episode.
Yes.
You know, I was reading about the spice route and how, you know, really, like, the desire to find spices drove so much of early exploration.
Oh, right. Sure,
I mean, it was...
Spices and dyes.
Oh, man. I mean, you know, just there would be literally ships going out with gold, trading them for peppercorns and bringing them back, you know,
at one time.
It was really valuable. Do you guys know where the Spice Islands... So the access to the original Spice Islands was huge. Back way back, we would get nutmeg, cloves, mace. A lot of things only grew in the Spice Islands.
Go ahead,
Karen. Where are these Spice Islands today?
Okay, so Spice Islands, they have a lot of these plants.
Yeah,
okay.
What part of what modern day country?
Fiji?
Indonesia.
Oh, okay.
Indonesia.
Well, there are a lot of islands.
Yes, there are many islands. Yeah, but I had always
like
heard that
Java,
term.
Like Java, that
the Spice
old area.
Islands. Yeah, yeah. Specifically, I guess it's the Malaccas or the Maluku Islands in Indonesia, which is sort of the original ancestral home of many of these spices that we now have
in
our racks.
Man, food must have been bland.
Food was pretty bland.
They're ready to send out ships filled with gold just to make things spicy.
Mm. I have an interesting...
Just to make things taste like things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did read... I read one historian was saying, you know, like...
No, cool crack little, the book out.
Let me create this cool little anecdote I found.
Who brings a book to a trivia podcast recording? Colin.
Who has books about spices?
Spice trivia.
On his bookshelf. Colin.
Colin.
I have a fun little anecdote here from the Bill Bryson book, At Home. He's talking about the birth of the spice trade. Quoting here, when the Goths threatened to sack Rome in 408 AD, the Romans bought them off with a tribute that included 3,000 pounds of pepper.
Oh my God.
Yes. That's
wait, pepper? Like
just pepper, peppercorns. And this one, for his wedding meal in 1468, Duke Carl of Borgogna ordered 380 pounds of black pepper, far more than even the largest wedding party could eat, and displayed it conspicuously so that people could see how fabulously wealthy he was.
Check out my
peppercorns. My pile of peppercorns, not gold or jewels, but yeah.
Peppercorns are berries, right?
They are, I believe, yes, technically a berry.
I wonder what they taste like when they're not dried up.
Pretty
like,
bitter,
probably
I believe.
Pretty bad.
Yeah.
So from I knew exactly what I was going to talk about as soon as Colin said spices. So I'm all about this topic. You may already know, you might already know about me. Certainly, you guys here in the Good Job Brain Studios, you understand my passion for the dish known as curry rice in Japan.
Oh,
Japanese
yes.
curry is my absolute favorite food of all time.
Not just normal curry.
It's
different.
There's all kinds of different regional variations on the dish known as curry out there in the world. But my absolute favorite is Japanese curry. It's more like comfort food. Like when most people think about curry, they think about like Indian curry or Thai curry, and it's a really hot, you know, make you sweat. Kind of like adventurous food that you might be eating. Japanese curry, really, the sensation for me is like, you know, like eating macaroni and cheese or something that's like warm, comforting, sweet kind of food. I'll tell you, people outside Japan do not understand like how popular curry rice is as a dish in Japan. There was a survey done by S&B, which is this company that really for the entire history of Japanese curry has been making curry powder. That was like the original Japanese curry powder. It's still sold today. They did a survey. People in Japan, on average, eat curry 78 times a year.
That's one and a half times a week.
Four or five days.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's more popular than sushi. It is by some measurements more popular than ramen. You know, so we in America, we eat a lot of, you know, people eat a lot of ramen. And we think, oh, that's a very typical Japanese food. We eat a lot of sushi. Oh, that's a very typical Japanese food. Curry, which is not nearly as popular outside Japan, is like head and shoulders above those foods.
Whoa.
As one of the most popular, well-liked, and most often eaten foods in Japan. Well, how did that happen?
Yeah.
How did that come to be? It's a really Japanese curry is a really strange dish because when I first moved there, I'd go to the school cafeteria and I'd get a plate of curry rice. I'm like, what is this? Oh, this is pretty good. And I took my chopsticks and I ate it. You know, I was able to do it pretty well. The plate is half white rice and then half this sort of brown curry sauce. And everybody was like, oh, you eat it with a spoon, which is the weirdest thing. Even in America, people don't understand what to do sometimes with curry. That like at a restaurant, they'll give you a fork, a spoon, and chopsticks. And people who don't know about curry will first they'll start with the chopsticks,
right?
And then if that doesn't work, they'll go to the fork. But the last thing they'll do is sit there with this plate of rice and sauce and maybe even a pork cutlet, like a breaded piece of pork on top of it. They're not going to take a spoon and eat that, but that is how you eat it.
I eat it the wrong
Japan.
Way. I just learned I eat it the wrong way.
Wait, yeah. You don't eat the meat with the...
I use the fork, and I guess I've been doing it like a chump.
You were supposed to use the spoon for the whole thing, and everything they do is made so you can eat it with a spoon. You're supposed to be able to cut the pork cutlet right in half with the edge of your spoon. Yep. Japanese curry and in terms of the flavor profile, I mean it does use the spices that are often found in curry dishes. Like if you were to take, you know, curry powder off the shelf. It can taste like a whole lot of different things. Japanese curry is usually sweeter than spicy curry. Mm. It's really just hard to describe what it tastes like without actually...
For me, I think it tastes, it's sweet and it's spicy mm-hmm. and it's salty. It's like a brown gravy.
Like, yeah, it's kind of like beef stew or yeah. something like that, but with more exotic like curry spices.
But it's also creamy at the same time.
Yeah.
It's like an Asian version of mole almost. Like it's so many things together.
Yeah, it's an interesting comparison.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right, yeah. Right. And it can be a lot of different things. I mean, you can have really bad curry and you can have really good curry. Well, let's talk about... curry, as in, you know, the spice mixture and the dish in general.
Oh yeah, what is curry?
And it means sauce. But it's specifically come to mean a meat and vegetable stew sort of concoction that uses certain spices, but it's like meat in sauce that has been heavily spiced to be very aromatic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but the word itself originates just from the word for sauce.
Like salsa.
Like salsa, exactly. Sauce.
What is right. salsa? Oh.
Just means sauce.
Sauce.
Yeah.
Just be really clear. There is no such spice as curry, right? It's a curry powder. When you go to the supermarket and you see, you know, oregano, and then you see curry powder.
Right.
That's not like a spice. Curry powder is so some common ones are coriander. The spice coriander is very prevalent in a lot of curry powders. Cumin and turmeric is another spice. I went to the pantry and I grabbed some curry powder and I grabbed some garam masala, which is the spice mix that they use in like chicken tikka masala, right? So the curry powder had coriander, fenugreek, turmeric, red pepper, and onion, like powdered onion. The garam masala had coriander, black pepper, cumin, cardamom, and cinnamon. So, but I mean, any curry you have might have any combination of those spices. It's always
going
to be
that.
A rich.
I thought there was like one thing that had to be in there to be called curry powder.
You know, so coriander seems to be the common ingredient between these two. But I believe I was reading somebody did a survey of many different recipes for chicken tikka masala and found out that the only ingredient in common was chicken across all of the recipes. Right. A mixture of spices and some kind of sauce with meat or vegetables, and you have curry. Wide range of different experiences throughout the world. So the first step on curry's journey from like the Indian subcontinent where it was sort of invented to Japan is through Britain, because Britain had, of course, you know, colonized India for a few centuries, and you had people going from countries like India and going and living in the UK and, like, you know, cooking food there. You had a lot of British people going and living in India and eating food there. And you got that cross-cultural, like, oh, curry is a thing. And they started really enjoying it. And so curry got very popular in Britain, especially around kind of the turn of the century in the 1900s when you actually had more, like, Indian or Pakistani or, like, Bangladeshi, like, restaurants started to open in.
Yeah, chicken tikka masala. That wasn't invented in India. That's a UK invention.
It was possibly invented in Glasgow.
Yeah.
By a Pakistani chef who claims to have invented chicken tikka masala in Glasgow, Scotland.
Yeah. It's not like a traditional
Indian
dish.
I didn't know that either.
But of course, it comes from that. I mean, the story that I read was the classic potato chips story where the customer sends the food back because he says, "Oh, your curry chicken is too dry." And the guy goes, "Well, dump some tomato soup in there and then it'll be wet for him, you know?" And then the guy's like, "I love it." You know, that kind of thing.
That classic
The classic
story.
Potato chip story. Yeah.
All right, so how to get from England to Japan?
In the Navy. So the Japan and Britain in the early part of the 20th century had an alliance, and their respective navies hung out together a lot because the ships would go from Japan to Britain, Britain to Japan, etc. And so I only found one source for this. It may have been a tactic to get the Japanese Navy to be healthier, because there's a website wrote about this called Taiken Japan is the name of the site. But they were writing about this part is definitely multiple sourced. Many Japanese people, including some of the sailors in the Navy, were getting a disease called beriberi, B-E-R-I-B-E-R-I.
It sounds like a really cute name for a disease.
For a bad disease. You could lose a lot of weight. You could have nervous system problems, like debilitating disorder. It was not good when people got this. And at first, well, they noticed that the British, you know, the British people don't have it. It's like, why don't they have it? They were like, oh, it must be endemic to Japan. It must be some sort of genetic thing to Japan.
Huh.
No, turns out it was a vitamin B1 deficiency, because all the Japanese dudes ate was white rice.
Mm.
And the white rice is rice has been stripped of the hulls and the husks and everything and all the stuff that has the vitamins in it.
Yeah.
So they were not getting enough vitamin B1, and that's what beriberi was. It was a vitamin B1 deficiency.
It's the scurvy for vitamin B.
It's scurvy for rice, basically. And so there was a doctor, there was a Japanese doctor who had kind of trained in Britain and hypothesized that it was a, you know, vitamin deficiency. And they were like, oh, we need to start giving these guys different foods. And what one of the things they landed on was the guys in the British Navy loved eating curry.
Huh.
So, and I'll tell you, Japanese curry is actually very similar in terms of the flavor profile to if you go to an Irish pub or you go to a British pub and you get curry chips, like French fries with curry. That is actually the closest thing there is to Japanese curry.
So interesting.
It's a gravy, yeah.
Right?
I had always just assumed that it came with like Buddhism, you know? I mean, like it followed the path from India into Asia. Like it makes a lot of sense.
That's a lot of people think. It would come over with the Buddhist monks.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. No, it went through Britain. And that's why you eat it with a spoon, because it is considered a Western food. It's very recent. It's the 1920s-ish when this was all happening.
Wow.
Yep. Yep. And so they add British dishes to the Japanese naval menu, and it catches on in a big way. And so, in fact, even today, the Japanese Navy is now the Maritime Self-Defense Force, right? Like, Friday is curry day. And every ship in the Japanese Navy now, they have perfected their own curry recipe.
It's like a chili cook-off.
Absolutely. It is unique to their ship, and they're all very proud of their curry recipes, and they have a yearly Navy curry cook-off.
That's awesome.
Yep, yep.
So when are we going?
And again, it trends towards sweetness. So some of the ingredients you'll find in the Navy curry are like chocolate, honey, red wine,
apples,
like a mole, jam, like you said, Karen. Yeah.
Apples are very popular. Parmesan cheese in one. Instant Ooh. Coffee is sometimes Ooh. Used.
Yeah.
To really give it its really rich depthness of flavor. So the Navy goes home to their families. They bring back the fact that they love curry, kind of. So curry powder at this point is an expensive British import, right? You still, even though you love curry, you still can't necessarily get the spices if you're like a poor Japanese family. Two major events happened to make curry the sort of culinary powerhouse that it is today in Japan. Number one, I'm going to quote directly from the Japan Times because this is beautiful. The great curry powder scandal of 1931,
da, da, da.
In which unscrupulous dealers were caught selling cheap domestic curry powder as expensive Cross and Blackwell powder from England. This escalated to an international diplomatic incident leading to several arrests. But it ironically gave a big boost to domestic curry powder manufacturers such as S&B Foods, since people discovered they couldn't really taste the difference. So, yeah. Event number two, 1954, is the intro of how, if you've had Japanese curry, if you've made it at home before, how you probably made it, which is the introduction
bricks.
Of the bricks, the curry bricks. So, I mean, to make curry, like, you have to go through a lot of processes. You got to, you know, melt down some onions. You got to, like, you know, make a roux with butter and flour. There's a lot of technique. There's a lot of things that can go wrong, and it takes a long time. The introduction of the instant curry bricks, which combined the spices, the thickening agents, all into it looks like a bar of chocolate, but I wouldn't eat it.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe a fancy soap.
Like a Dove chocolate bar.
You break off some bricks, you toss it into some hot water, and you will get a thick curry. The important thing with this is actually when Japanese moms make curry at home, like generally this is what they use. Like it's not, you know, people will make curry from scratch, sure, but it's like this is how you actually like get dinner on the table.
Right, right.
Importantly, you start with the brick.
Your base.
Start the recipe, and then the rest is what you do with it. You know, adding honey to it and, like, doing more stuff with it over the course of cooking it. Yeah, meat.
Chris, when you say that you're a Japanese curry expert, what are your accolades? Have you been in a magazine? let's say?
It's funny that you should mention this, because if you were to go and purchase, which I don't think you can anymore, the April 2016 issue of GQ Japan, that's actual GQ, the Japanese version, there is an article called Obsessed with Curry, 15 People's Curry Lifestyle. And it's like Japanese actors and comedians.
And one crazy American.
And one
Mr. Chris.
Crazy American. And that is me. They were showing me the layout of the magazine, and it was like a placeholder photo, and it just was captured like Mr. Chris. He is eating happily with curry. Yeah, and so that's now on the... If you go to Fumi Curry in Bernal Heights here in San Francisco, they put it up on the... Not only do they put it up on the wall, they put it up on the window facing outside into the street.
Nice.
So if you walk by the
see
place,
your face.
You will see my smiling face with a spoonful of curry.
The proper way.
You had a GQ photo shoot.
I had a GQ photo shoot.
Wow, not a lot of people can say that.
That wasn't even on the bucket list, but I put it on the bucket list and then crossed it off immediately.
I want some coffee curry. That sounds pretty good.
Well, yeah. I mean, it all kind of...
They're in that, the coffee, chocolatey, I can see that.
Yeah, caramelly, molasses, kind of burnt.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, like some Guinness curry. That could work pretty well.
You know the Guinness stew? Mm-hmm. Like you get at
Pubs? Yeah.
It's very similar to Japanese curry.
It is.
All right, let's take a quick break. We're getting hungry, and we'll be right back.
Hello. It is I, Elvis, the Good Job Brain 80s robot. I am here to announce that the official Good Job Brain book will be available this fall. Segments, quizzes, original illustrations, puzzles, and weird facts to entertain you humans while you humans engage in your bodily waste excavation sessions in the space known as the toilet. The book will be in both paperback and ebook versions. And you can even pre-order the paperback version on Amazon today. See you on the toilet.
Welcome back. You're listening. Good Job Brain. This week we're talking about things that are spicy.
I have a music quiz for you guys.
Oh, is it all Spice Girls?
And no, in fact, it is not all Spice Girls.
I was like, I'm gonna win.
The answer to every song is Spice Girls.
So, usually, when we do these music quizzes or at pub quiz, you get the songs and you've got to tell me the theme. I'm gonna invert it here. I'm just gonna tell you outright the theme is spices and seasonings and herbs and all in that.
Seasonings more broadly.
Yeah, herbs, spices, seasonings. And that is the theme of this music quiz. So
it could be in the artist name or the title
could
song?
Could be in the artist name, could be the name of the song, could be in the lyrics, could be some other, hopefully not crazy, connection somewhere to spices, herbs, seasonings. So here we go. For each track, tell me who is the musical artist. First track. Both of you buzzed in, but I think Chris is a little quicker.
Tony Basil.
Yes, Tony.
Basil?
I would say Basil, personally.
Well, the British.
Yes, again, the British-English
Basil
distinction.
Basil. Wow.
Yes, Tony Basil. Yes, correct.
Yeah.
With Mickey.
Yes.
Hey, Mickey.
I looked this up. It may not surprise you to know that Tony Basil is a stage name. But this is where it gets...
Why did she choose it?
This is hilarious. This sounds made up, but I swear it's not. Her real name is Antonia Christina Basilotta. It really is. Basilotta. Yeah. I guess she can...
That's very
80s. Yes, very 80s.
Yep. So Italian?
Yes,
it's
Italian.
Like Antonia Basilotta. That won't fit on a 45 record label. Now you Tony Basil, kid.
I can see it now.
Yeah. Hands are $50. You're in the music business.
Well, I guess she came from a performing family, and her father was an orchestra leader under the name Louis Basil. So wasn't the first one in her family to think, this is going to be a little more...
Cut that down.
Yeah, cut that down. All right, next track. I'm sure you guys have heard the song before, but who is this artist?
Artist.
Both of you guys at the same time.
The are we?
Yeah, go
out?
For it. Both of you.
I was gonna give it to you because I, you know, we both
Karen, please.
At the same time.
Yeah, go ahead.
The Archies.
Yes, it is the Archies. Yes, the fictional musical group.
Yeah. And it's the Archie comic people,
you know,
right?
It is the Archie comic people, right? I mean, it was created for the Archie show and presented as if it was the Archie character singing the song. I didn't know how big of a hit that song was. It was the number one Billboard single for 1969.
Oh my God!
Yeah, yeah, it was on top for many weeks, and then it charted again in 1970, covered by Wilson Pickett. Of all people.
Oh.
Yes, a proper musical cover. Good Life for Sugar Sugar by the Archies. Next track. Tell me, who is this band?
For the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on Trampoline. The Hendersons will all be there. Late of Pablo Bank is there. What a scene. Over men and horses, hoops and garters, lastly through a hogshead of real fire.
Oh.
Chris.
This is Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, as memorably portrayed by The
Beatles.
Ooh, what a fantastically worded answer. Yes. I love it. Yes, yes. I would have accepted the Beatles.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
What was the song name?
That is Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite.
Okay.
Yes.
So they're cosplaying as Sergeant Pepper.
Well, the whole album.
Yeah, that's the concept album.
Yeah,
okay.
The whole album is that they're presented as...
Hence Pepper.
Right. Yeah. You know, obviously a big carnival circus atmosphere to that song. I learned this. Almost all of the lyrics and the imagery from this song were inspired directly from...
Oh, by a poster.
A circus poster that John Lennon had bought in an antique shop. And, I mean, it's just so whimsical, but... Everything on there, you know, Pablo Fanke, like everything on there was straight from this poster.
Right.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Right, yep.
Really interesting. I read Lennon, when they were producing the album, he told George Martin, their producer, that he wanted to, quote, smell the sawdust on the floor. And I think he accomplished that.
Yeah.
Next track. Who is this artist? Chris.
Paprika Jones.
Paprika Jones. I wish I could give you a star for Paprika Jones.
Hooter.
Karen, you want to take a stab? This is a big 90s hit.
Veruca Salt?
Yes.
Wow. Oh, I pulled that out of my butt.
Yes.
I was
yes.
like, what is seasoning pepper and has girl bands?
You nailed it. You nailed it. That was in the punch bowl. Yeah, that is a Seether, the biggest hit by far for Veruca Salt. Of course, named after the character from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yes.
I want it now. All right, next track. Who is this artist? Karen, right away.
Well, I mean, it took me a while. The Sugar Cubes.
Yes, you got it
eventually.
Cubes. Yes.
Bjork.
Yes, that is Bjork as lead singer of the Sugar Cubes.
That's who I would have guessed, but I did not know about the Sugar Cubes connection.
Yep, that is a hit. One of Iceland's most famous bands. Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I like Sigur Rós too.
But, Sigur Rós.
Yeah, that's why I said three more. Yeah. all right, next track. This is a very... I'm not going to give you any hints. Next track. Who is performing?
Jumps right out at you. 10-3 won the calendar. In Texas, a hell raises born like the chainsaw massacre. Hills have eyes in Texas, kids. Stories about what next he did. Doctor slapped him on his ass. His head spun round like exorcist. Bad enough for quarantine. Mess with him, you're gonna scream. They said he had a shining. He saw red rum and evergreen. Omen since he was a teen. Freddy Krueger on the scene. Slicing up MCs.
Oh, Chris. Chris is gonna take a stab. Who do we got?
Is it the Red Hot Chili Peppers?
It is not the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
What was your hint, though?
The hint is this is a new track from someone who was famous a long time ago.
Huh.
Karen.
Vanilla Ice.
That is Vanilla Ice. Yes, this is Born on Halloween from his most recent album, WTF, released in 2011. Also featuring Violent J on that track from Insane Clown Posse.
Oh, okay.
Going for kind of a horror-y theme there. Mm. All right, last one, last track. Here we go. A little bit of a novelty song here.
Okay.
Who is this artist? Chris.
Is that the Red Hot Chili Peppers?
That is the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Yes.
That's the Robert Johnson song, Hot Tamales, parentheses, They're Red Hot.
You are all over it.
Wow,
absolutely
what?
Right. Yeah, that is They're Red Hot, written by legendary bluesman Robert Johnson. Mm-hmm. That's right, from the 30s, which was already sort of a novelty song when he wrote it. The Red Hot Chili Peppers sped it up considerably.
Yeah.
That almost sounded like... backwards.
All right, well, that was it. I think you guys did a perfect 7 for 7 there. Good job. Well done.
Together.
Yeah, well, you know, there's only two of you, too. It's always a little trickier with no Dana.
That's right.
All right, I'm going to close the show. Chris, you took on a journey with curry rice. I'm going to take on a journey with another food item, a spicy food item. And also, it's so weird, because I didn't know you were going to do that segment. So it just makes me think that... This is why I love Good Job Brain, because, like, there are things that we don't really... vernacular, normal things. And then when you, like, research more about it to find out why it is the way it is, it's so interesting. It's like, oh, the British and then the Japanese Navy. It's like, oh, my God. I wouldn't know. And I just thought it was, like, a sauce, you know? Let me ask you guys. When you guys go to a Thai restaurant...
A Thai restaurant?
A Thai restaurant.
Yeah.
What can you name me some food items that you see from a Thai restaurant menu? Like dishes. Just list out things.
Pad Thai, yellow curry,
Meat on a stick,
satay,
crab rangoons.
That's cream cheese.
I'm having trouble here.
But Colin, you said a number one thing you think of Thai food is probably Pad Thai.
I think certainly in America. I think in America, for sure. Yeah,
most I'd say Western places. You go to a Thai restaurant, that's kind of that's the thing you get. It has Thai in the name. It's Pad Thai.
Yeah, if you don't know where else to start with a dish that has the country's name in it.
And Pad Thai, how would you describe Pad Thai?
I would describe it as, it's got a lot of ingredients. Little bit sweet, a little bit tangy. You got some noodles, you got some peanut, you got some vegetables in there, some egg.
It's basically a hodgepodge stir-fry rice noodle dish.
Yeah.
Your base is rice noodle. It's in an orangey red sauce or spicy sauce, stir-fried together with eggs, chicken, seafood, bean sprouts, just random things
all
in one thing. And it's sweet and it's tangy. Pad Thai is a weird dish because you associate it with Thailand.
Are you gonna tell me this is nothing that was not
was
also
like
invented
in
the country
America, like 50 years ago?
No, not quite.
Okay.
Not quite.
Sorry, I don't mean to hijack your
No.
I've just been so disillusioned here.
It's like, turns out wasabi's not real wasabi. You're like, oh my God, what are you doing to my food? Yeah. I don't believe anything now. So here's a story of in 1938, a guy, military gentleman, Phoebun Songkram, Most people now in Western culture just refer to him as Phibun. And he became prime minister of Thailand. Mm. 6 years before this, he played a prominent role in a military coup.
They have military coups a lot in Thailand.
That basically stripped Thailand's monarchy from its absolute power. So this was back when Thailand was known as Siam. Mm. In fact, he was the guy behind the driving force to change the name from Siam to Thailand. And so Phibun is both famous and infamous. On one hand, he helped establish a national modern identity for Thailand, but also was a fascist ruler and aligned with the Axis power in World War II. And so some quick background, just because Thailand is very interesting in history, especially, you know, Chris, you talked about India and colonization. And Thailand, in South Asia, Thailand or Siam back then had never been colonized. Never been colonized. But around its borders are all countries with British and French colonies. You have Vietnam, you have, you know, parts of, you have India, you have, you know, Hong Kong. Right. Like, all, they're surrounded by these forces. And so Phibun, he was European educated. He wanted Thailand to have a strong, modern, unified identity. Siam was a mix of hodgepodge of, like, local subcultures. Different, you know, kind of tribal cultures with different dialects, different language, different customs. And also, Thailand had a lot of Chinese influence, too. There were a lot of Chinese immigrants. There were schools there. People were speaking Chinese. And he wanted a real, united identity.
He was a nationalist.
Part of his rule, he passed a 12 cultural mandates. 12 cultural mandates that were new rules that people of Siam, or now Thailand, needed to live by.
Sounds pretty fascist.
Some of these rules, like, seem very nationalistic. Like, here is the official anthem. Here's our national anthem. Mm-hmm. And some of them were, people of Thailand are called Thai. The language is Thai, you know, not Siam anymore. And then some of these rules were like, hey, you should wear hats and you should wear pants and shirts because different tribal had different native clothes. Some of them, the women were topless. And
it's like a national dress code.
Yeah, national dress code. There's also national, like, you should spend a third of your day working, a third of your day with family. And like, to that point. And one of them was buy and use and produce Thai products. Directly food. Food, food, food.
Okay.
Because Thailand, their main export was rice. And their whole diet was mostly rice-centric. And rice is being sold to China, to other parts of Asia. And Phibun was like, no, we want to cut that connection. And so he thought, okay, Thailand needs a national dish that does not include rice.
Huh.
But at the same time, is nutritious enough for everybody and tastes good.
Okay.
That dish, the Pad Thai dish, is actually a Chinese dish. It's stir-fried rice noodles. The only the only Thai thing is the spices that were put in. It was called, you know, stir-fried noodles Thai style.
Interesting.
Just like in China, there's also in Chinese culture, there's like fried rice Singaporean style. It really is a Chinese dish, but he basically
co-opted it.
Yeah, co-opted it. Hmm. This is our national dish.
It's like a national dish by fiat.
That's precisely what it was.
It was propaganda.
You will all eat this.
You all have to eat this. So then you have street vendors selling Pad Thai on the street. It became like fast food because it was very, it was just hodgepodge of things stir fried with rice noodles. That became the national Thai dish. And this is in, you know, within the last century.
Yeah, yeah. It did not come out naturally.
Right. No. It was not a traditional dish.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is the name, what does the pad in Pad Thai mean?
Noodles.
So, okay.
Or stir fried,
Thai style.
All noodles. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
It's weird because it's almost like an oxymoron. It's like, we got to be more Thai. So this is our national dish, which is
a Chinese dish
that we're trying to cut connections to.
Yeah.
But also made out of ingredients that, you know, the only thing that we have is like the spices. Tamarind, pepper.
Yeah, I definitely associate
chili.
Some tamarind. Yeah.
So that's kind of the orange sauce of it. But all the other stuff is just kind of like what came to be.
Mm-hmm.
Different places had different types of Pad Thai. Pad Thai.
Delicious propaganda.
Delicious fascism.
I'm hungry.
I'm really hungry.
Spices. Let's do the cinnamon challenge.
What's the cinnamon challenge?
What?
You don't know the cinnamon challenge?
Oh, my God. This is never do this. Not maybe in your youthful days you might have done
it. It's like one of these viral self pranks.
Yeah, it's the cinnamon challenge is you YouTube yourself, right? But it's basically just you're supposed to eat a spoonful of cinnamon, but it dries out your mouth so quickly.
Yeah, I bet it's not the spice.
It's not the spice. It's the fact that it's so dry that it just sucks all the saliva out of your mouth. You can't swallow without saliva. But you end up basically like choking.
Yeah,
you end up coughing and it's a bad time. It's a bad time.
All the videos end up with people coughing, eyes running, water. Yeah.
But the cinnamon just like instantly just like sucks up any moisture that was ever in there. Yeah, it's painful.
That doesn't even sound...
And then you inhale a little bit of it.
No.
Right.
That doesn't sound fun or funny. So kids, don't do
this. Please, please do not. Yeah.
So we'll go eat some food with some spices in it is what we're saying.
Yeah. And that is our show. Thank you guys for joining me. And thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learn a lot of stuff about the Japanese Navy. What are they called again? Maritime Defense?
The Maritime Self-Defense Force.
Mm, yep. Some Tony Basil, Pad Thai, Belmont Steaks, and, of course, our pet camel, Alexander Humpington. You can find our show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, and on our website, goodjobbrain.com. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye. Alexander.